This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Before I bring on my first guest, who I've actually had on a number of times, Linda Feldman from the Christian Science Monitor, I read something at The Intercept. It's too incredible. And I'm just going to share part of this story at The Intercept, but enough for you to sort of catch my drift. And more importantly, go to The Intercept, and I'll link it on our Facebook page and read it. Ryan Grimm wrote the following. Here's the headline. Federal judge lambasts amendment to rename Confederate bases as a madness, gets thoroughly body slammed by clerk. Here's how it goes. The battle over renaming U.S. bases that currently honor Confederate officers broke out in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. on Monday. But the argument was not in the courtroom. Rather, it was launched and settled over email. In an email sent circuit-wide on Sunday, Judge Lawrence Silberman, a Reagan appointee, lambasted Senator Elizabeth Warren for her amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, requiring the military to strip the names of rebel officers from any military assets. And this is what he writes. Since I'm about to be interviewed, I thought it would be appropriate to unburden myself in opposition to the madness proposed by Senator Warren, the desecration of Confederate graves, Silverman writes. And then he goes on and he sends this email out, Ken, to all the judges and everyone in the circuit. Some of his relatives, one side was on the Confederate side, one side was on the Union side, and he just goes on and waxes poetic. In fact, I am sure my great-great-grandfather never owned slaves, as best as I can tell. So he sent this out, and it went out to every court staff person and every judge and everybody in the court, right? It was left unanswered over the next day until a law clerk decided to respond. So the law clerk goes, "Hi, Judge Silberman," began the career-risking reply email. "I am one of only five Black law clerks in this entire circuit. However, the views I express below are solely my own. Since no one in the court's leadership has responded to your message, I thought I would give it a try." I love this guy. "My maternal ancestors were enslaved in Mississippi. While the laws of this nation viewed my ancestors as property, I view them as hostages. In a hostage situation, when someone does something that leads to the freeing of the hostages, I am not sure if the hostages would be concerned as to whether the person that saved them actually intended to save them. In this instance, as people consider to be property, my ancestors would not have been involved in the philosophical and political debates about Lincoln's true intentions or his view on racial equality. For them and myself, race is not an abstract topic to be debated. So in my view, anything that was built to represent white racial superiority or named after someone who fought to maintain white supremacy or their southern economy of slavery, see photo of Liberty Monument attached, should be removed from high trafficked areas of prominence and placed in, you know, museums where they can be part of lessons that get put in context. In your message, you talked about your ancestors, one that fought for the Confederacy and then one that fought for the Union. This seems to be a true example of a house divided. However, it is very clear what the Confederacy stood for. In 1861, at the Virginia Secession Convention, Henry Benning, for whom Fort Benning is named, is in explaining the reason for Georgia's decision to secede from the United States, stated, and I quote, "It was a conviction that a separation from the North was the only thing that could prevent the abolition of her slavery. It is probable that the white race, being superior in every respect, may push the other back," close quote. Unfortunately, in this scenario, no matter how bravely your uncle fought for the Confederacy, the foundation of his fight was a decision that he agreed more with the ideals of the Confederacy than he did with those of the Union. And in the end, he chose the losing side of history. Whoa! And it was almost like he turned the switch on, and then all of a sudden, some of the judges got some nerve to respond, and somebody else got the nerve to respond. But isn't this amazing, Ken?
It's fabulous. It's fabulous, and it's beautifully written. It is factually full of
brilliant
video. And he tells it like it is, and he has the courage to speak truth to power. This guy is fabulous.
I want this person to get profiles and courage. This law clerk is incredible. But what was so interesting, apparently what his argument was, Lincoln really didn't want to free the slaves. It was really about keeping the Union together. So he was arguing all these sort of reasons, and therefore, and this guy, that's why the hostage line. You know, I don't care who freed me, I'm free. You know, I don't care what their back story was. But this is the other part of the email where he says, and he's sort of complimenting the judge. And he says, you know, I just want to note that the current movement to rename government-owned facilities is in line with your previous opinions on the importance of names and what they represent. He said, why, in 2005, you publicly advocated for the removal of J. Edgar Hoover's name from the FBI building due to the problematic material you came across in your review of his FBI files after his death. I love this person. This person has got to be a judge. I'm just telling you, this law clerk Absolutely. Needs to be a judge someday. You know, this is too good that it really needs to be read out loud. So there you go.
And spread widely. Yes.
Now I want to go to an article at the Christian Science Monitor. Maybe not equally amazing, no offense, because it doesn't make you smile the way the last conversation went. I've been reading the Christian Science Monitor since I was a little girl. My father used to read it to me at night, that and the Wall Street Journal. Linda has joined me on many occasions, and Linda Feldman wrote an article at the Christian Science Monitor. And I thought, you know, this is really an important conversation to have as we look and want to blame the Trump administration for everything that's wrong, from the economy to how the response to the pandemic. But as you point out in the headline in your piece at the Christian Science Monitor, you said, shaky COVID response lays bare a decades-long crisis in government. And the subtitle is, a highly politicized system that encourages short-term thinking has hindered the government's pandemic response, as have outmoded technology, overlapping mandates, and a steep decline in public trust. So let me welcome Linda Feldman to the program. You, I believe, are the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Am I correct?
Yes, I am.
So let's talk a little bit about this. It is decades long. There is a real difference between the Republican Party that taught me, a liberal progressive Democrat, in the 1980s, and the Republican Party that I see today. And part of the problem with the Republican Party I see today is that not only has it gotten more extreme, not only has it been defined by the word no, but it actually changed the Democratic Party as well. Mm-hmm. So as they moved to the right, as they became more anti-government, as they became more of a party of no, as opposed to a party of let's find some consensus here, it also forced the Democratic Party to also, I think, move to some extent to the right and not want to put the time and energy in mm-hmm. into investing in long-term decision-making, because everything now had been defined by what I think the Republicans wanted to do, which was sort of undermine policy, undermine the ability to have revenue to make the requisite investments, and undermine a long-term strategy. And if that's what they wanted, the Democrats sort of followed suit.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's a difference between what the Republicans wanted to do. There was this anti-government feeling. You had Ronald Reagan, who famously said the most feared words were, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, something along those lines. So he was just full on anti-government. The government can't do anything right. And we need to smother the baby in the cradle and allow the private sector to do its thing and keep government as small as possible. So Bill Clinton comes along, and his approach as a centrist Democrat is not to smother government, but to make it smaller and more efficient. So he famously said the era of big government is over.
Correct.
Which didn't mean we're going to kill government. It meant we're going to modernize government. And in particular, with Al Gore at the lead, take the innovations, the technological innovations, and put them in government and make government work better. And President Clinton, with Al Gore's assistant, was able to actually shrink the size of the federal government by 300,000 people. And I'm old enough to remember that era. And I don't remember a lot of people screaming about losing their jobs. I mean, this happened, I think, in a very organic way and was effective. But that era is now also over.
The Clinton era. Can I ask you a question about that era before we leave Bill Clinton? I do remember the idea of the era of big government is over. I do remember that he tasked Al Gore with sort of reinventing government. Sure. That was kind of the language of it. So sure. I'm kind of curious, they may have shrunk government,
right?
But that isn't necessarily efficient, and that isn't necessarily reinvention, and right. that isn't essentially modernizing.
Correct.
Did Al Gore and Bill Clinton, as they reduced the size of government by 300,000, really create efficiency? Did they really sort of create modernization? Did they bring in new technology, or did they basically not hire people?
No, they brought in new technology. I mean, they eliminated the whole kind of central layer of government. And by some telling, what they did was that led to a lot of contractors, right? So they hollowed out the middle level of government. You have the lowest level of people, the clerks, the people who process the checks, basically, and make sure people get their Social Security payments and the Medicare system, keep that functioning. But it's that middle level that got kind of weeded out. What they didn't do was eliminate a lot of the inefficiencies that we're seeing today in the overlapping mandates of many departments. So you have in the pandemic, you're seeing the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration and the National Institutes of Health. They have separate functions, but they overlap, and you're not seeing any effort to eliminate that inefficiency and allow for clear voices to step to the fore. So of course, the missing ingredient here that we're seeing today is strong leadership from the White House. We're seeing this kind of chaotic effort to manage this and to deal with varying political forces that are weighing from different directions.
Overlap isn't a bad thing. I mean, let me start by saying that, because everyone has their sphere of influence. Everyone's sort of in their silo, but not every silo can be discrete. There really needs to be some kind of overlap. And sometimes overlap with strong leadership means that what you're getting is you're getting coordination. You're getting people to talk to each other. I mean, that was one of the things we realized after 9/11. You know, the right hand wasn't talking to the left hand. The FBI said, this is what I do. The CIA said, this is what I do. Everyone, and it turned out that you really couldn't operate in those separate silos, that there needed to be some kind of integration. You needed kind of like a quilt of government in order to function. And so by definition, overlap isn't bad. What I think you got, though, with President Trump is he doesn't value leadership. Right. He doesn't really believe that there needs to be any kind of oversight. Frankly, what he likes is he wants to sort of place the responsibility on the states because he doesn't want the responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then when the responsibility comes roaring back because it does require a federal government response, there's no preparation. There's no one in charge. I mean, it was supposed to be Jared Kushner initially, who was going to sort of, you know, reinvent government at the federal level. And so I'm kind of looking at this, and not only do you have a guy who doesn't necessarily value policy, I think he doesn't quite understand what his job is, because he's never had to sort of organize anything bigger than the family business.
Right. So there's this theory that Donald Trump doesn't really understand the government that he's at the top of. That he doesn't really get how the bureaucracy works and how he can marshal the assets that he has at his disposal. So what he really needed to do, according to many people I talked to, was appoint a person and not the vice president. So he started out with the Secretary of Health and Human Services. That didn't work. Then he puts Mike Pence in charge. But that also doesn't work, because the vice president that's not really the appropriate role for the vice president. You need somebody, an assistant, a special advisor to the president, like a czar, in the way that Ron Klain was for President Obama during the Ebola pandemic, to just have that be their only thing that they do.
Right.
And that somebody who understands all the different government assets they have at their disposal, whether it's the CDC or the NIH or FDA, and also the WHO, the World Health Organization, work with them because it's a global issue, and have that person just do that. So Donald Trump has not been willing to do that.
Why, Linda? Why? See, what I think is that the reason why there is no czar is he doesn't want to own the problem. You see, if you think this is your nation, your problem, your pandemic, and you need to deal with it, then you will own it. And you will own it by appointing a czar. You will respect the scientists and the doctors. Donald Trump doesn't want to be responsible. And if you appoint a czar, you're accepting responsibility. By keeping it chaotic and by changing the story and by saying the pandemic is over or we don't need to test anymore, if we stop testing, we wouldn't have a pandemic. As you see all this, part of the problem is you may have a rickety, old, antiquated system coming into the Trump White House, but there still was something there. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump doesn't want to own what's even there.
So he wants to own it if it worked. So it's kind of a heads I win, tails you lose scenario. He kind of wants to own any aspect of this. It works. Let's say that today is as bad as it gets and things are gradually better and better and better. I'm not saying this is happening, but let's just presuppose.
Right. Magical thinking, but we'll make your fairy tale work.
It's going to just go away. And by November 3rd, the green shoots of an economic recovery are evident. Then he can own that. He can take credit for that. And he hopes win re-election. If by November 3rd, it's a wholesale mess, then he wants to be able to point to the governors and say, this is the governor's job. They have screwed up. It's not on me. So he's trying to, I mean, he would prefer the former scenario where you have the green shoots of recovery. I mean, you see him grabbing onto any good piece of economic news. You had great news out today about retail coming back, that it had crashed. And then in May, it really showed a lot of recovery. Well, he's picking.
I understand that the retail numbers, I mean, for the first 2 or 3 months of the shutdown, I don't think I ever got in my car.
Right.
Okay? Right. I mean, I've gotten to my car, but where have I gone? You know, I've gone to the grocery store, and I think I went to Lowe's twice. You know? But I got in my car. I hadn't even gotten to my car. I mean, what does that tell you? But I'm not going anywhere, and I'm not shopping. So there is going to be a bump. But I think what's so scary about all this is that what we're seeing in places like Florida, in places like Texas, in places like Oklahoma, is that people are like, you know, they're all going out. And then all of a sudden, if all the hospital beds start filling up again, he's going to have a double whammy because they'll have shut everything down. Everything will have opened up. People will be so, you know, excited. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be frightened again in a way that is even, I think, more devastating to an economy because I'm not sure it can sort of shrink twice. Mm-hmm. And yet that might happen to him.
Right. And another really important piece of all of this is the declining trust in government that we've seen over many, many decades. Yes. Pew Research Center has charted this. Like over the last 50 years, we've seen trust in the federal government really take a huge hit. And so the president can't go before the nation and tell people what to do because about more than half the country does not trust the federal government.
But who do they trust, Linda? Did you hear the attorney from Atlanta that's dealing with the Mr. Brooks death at the Wendy's? And he said something very powerful because this wasn't about the federal government. Mm-hmm. He said, I don't know what the term trust means.
Right.
I don't know who to trust. And this was the attorney. And this wasn't about the federal government. This is a level of exhaustion of trust where you see it with the African-American community with Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. We did an interview with a professor from Hamline University who was talking about what happened in Minneapolis. And he said, it's a tale of two cities. Mm-hmm. If you're white in Minneapolis, it's a great place to live. If you're black, it's not.
Right.
He said, and so there's that level of trust in the federal government has also, I think, gone down the food chain that people are beginning not to trust their state government.
That's right.
They're beginning not to trust their city government. Mm-hmm. And so what infected, you know, Washington has now, unfortunately, it's got shoots too, but they're not green shoots, they're rotted shoots. And that I think has caused, I think, a synergistic effect where everyone doesn't even know what to believe anymore.
Right.
Yes, I think that's 100% true, Arnie, and very important. I just want to add, when we talk about the lack of trust, that people don't trust the government or anybody else, I think part of that is not that, oh, gee whiz, we have a problem because people don't trust government. The problem is that they're right for not trusting government or our system or Wall Street the way our economy is run, because in actual fact, they're right. Mm-hmm. They're not getting any help. There are two systems, one for poor people and minorities, and the other for the very wealthy, and never the twain shall meet. And the government does not even purport to serve, mm-hmm. well, I guess they purport, but they don't mm-hmm. actually serve the 98%. And so, of course, the 98% isn't going to trust the government, because they look outside and they're getting screwed.
But Linda, what's really interesting to me is in your article, it's not even about the fact that, you know, everyone isn't sure who to trust anymore. And you mentioned mm-hmm. the Pew survey. There's a quote in your article where you're talking about the CDC. Paul Leiter, professor of public service at New York University, said, "The CDC is the poster child for an undermined, underengaged workforce." Right. I mean, so even within the federal government, we have depleted resources. We've depleted people. They're not able mm-hmm. to respond in an effective way. We mm-hmm. have set government up to fail.
Right. And part of it is just the nature of the leadership of each of these agencies. So I live right in Washington, D.C., and I'm surrounded by federal workers. Nobody wants to be quoted on the record, so you didn't see any federal workers quoted in my article. But I asked people about working for the government, and people told me that in the government, every agency has a suggestion box, and it's real. And I said, well, do they ever, if you put something in the suggestion box, does anybody do anything? And I'm told that it varies greatly by agency. So if you work for the CDC, not so much. But you know what government agency does really well in terms of employee satisfaction and responsiveness by leadership to the suggestions of the employees is NASA. The space agency. Every year, this nonprofit called the Partnership for Public Service, which examines the effectiveness and the satisfaction of people who work for the federal government, they do these surveys, and NASA does really well, CDC does really badly, for whatever reason. It may be lack of leadership at CDC in particular. So the libertarians would say, the CDC has taken on way too much. Their job is to track infectious diseases like COVID. They've taken on gun violence and smoking and vaping and all these other things that are happening. And it's just way too much. And the answer isn't to just throw more money at these agencies. The answer is to really bring them down to their core function and let them do that well, and not just load all these assignments.
Well, I understand why we load the assignments, but let's also understand something else. We load the Defense Department with a lot of assignments too, but here's the difference. Mm. We give them lots of money.
That's right.
I mean, they don't even know how much
money. That's right. They get so much money, they don't know what to do with all of it. I know.
Part of the thing, I want to go back to what you said with the Clinton era and the Gore era about how they got rid of 300,000 workers. No, they didn't. They contracted it out. So now we've got subcontractors and people that technically aren't on the payroll, but guess what? They are on the payroll because we're paying them. So, you know, it's so interesting to me that if we want to bring back trust, what we have to do is not only bring back trust, but if we're going to create an assignment for government, mm-hmm. we need to make sure that they're funded to accomplish the assignment.
Right.
Because to say that they're going to do something and then have them not deliver is why people don't believe anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're supposed to be telling me about gun violence, but you can't follow up on it, well, then you don't give a crap about gun violence. If you care about public health, and yet we don't have a system to respond to public health. And I think that's part of the problem right now is that people are so mm-hmm. upset about what they see, because mm-hmm. what they see is they're told that something is going to happen, and then it doesn't happen, Linda. So mm-hmm. why bother even telling them anymore?
Since you're going back to the Clinton administration, one other thing, in addition to what Linda was saying about wiping out the middle level and contracting out, I think that one other thing that didn't happen in the Clinton administration was any kind of balancing or rebalancing mm-hmm. of how the government spends its money. So we have the military, which is not only getting tons of money, but they're allowed to spend $500 on a hammer and nail, and and we have all these supersonic bombers and whatnot and bombs that we don't need. And instead of reallocating some of that extra firepower that may be overkill to defend our nation, they could have moved some of that money to have more money for public mm-hmm. health or more money True. For the Labor Department or human rights.
But Linda, isn't part of the problem too, and I go back to your, what are people saying are the solutions? So all right, we know that they don't trust. We know it's been decades mm-hmm. long. We know that Donald Trump may be an anomaly, but he is building on a system that was already sort of falling apart to start. So all we needed was him to completely make it crash. And then we had a pandemic on top of that. But what a cocktail of failure. But you can't live in the future with this kind of system. You need to begin to repair it. So as you were talking to people about this article, again, I'm going to remind everyone, Linda Feldman writes for Christian Science Monitor, Shaky COVID Response Lays Bare a Decades-Long Crisis in Government. What are the building blocks that we need to start to begin to sort of reestablish a government that functions where people can actually see it functioning for them?
We need to have planning. We need to have what's called surge capacity, which is something that's very much a part of military planning. Our military is constantly planning for all kinds of terrible things. And in the civilian sector, one of the things I wrote about was how we in the National Security Council kept opening an office of biothreats, which would look out for pandemics, and then we kept closing it because people would say, well, that's never going to happen. When's the last time we had a pandemic that was so awful that it shut down the country? It's been 100 years. Well, guess what? We're having that again. So suffice it to say, they're not going to shut down that office again. So, Clinton opened it, then Bush closed it, then he opened it again, open, close. Well, that is, I think, after the memory of what we're going through now, that will be a permanent feature. But the larger point is that we have to stop having these failures of imagination. 9/11 was a failure of imagination. Everything looks clear in hindsight. You can see, it was easy to see that this was coming, but we didn't see it in real time because you're like, well, that's not going to happen. This idea of terrorists flying planes into the World Trade Center. Who knew? Well, it happened. Pandemic. We had the advance warning. We had warning from China in early January that this was coming, and nobody did anything. And then now we're dealing with the consequences. So I think part of it is just having people who can see around corners and have the ability to take, you don't need to have the kind of army, whether it's in public health or in the actual army, you don't need to have them working full time, but we have a National Guard, which is available when you need that surge. You need sort of a National Guard of public health that can jump in when there's a looming pandemic and kind of nip that thing in the bud so that we can be South Korea, which flattened the curve immediately, as opposed to us, which didn't.
So I'm going to let you go. We got to get you back on, Linda. I'd love to talk to you. But I want to go back to the fact that you pointed to the military as being very good at the surge capacity. Mm-hmm. And you're right, they are. We got all these weapons over here in case there's a problem. Mm-hmm. We got these nukes over here in case there's a problem. We've got these ships over here in case there's a problem. So for the military to have surge capacity, they can point to like stockpiles of weapons. The problem with public health, mm-hmm. the problem with climate change, is that the surge capacity doesn't look like a weapon. Mm-hmm. The surge capacity isn't built by Raytheon. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's about people. Right. It's about skills. Mm-hmm. It's about making an investment and not sure whether you're going to use that investment in that social worker or that healthcare person for 10 years, but they need to be trained to be ready to respond. Mm-hmm. And that's harder to do than what the military gets to do, because the military can envision a lot of weaponry in order to respond. But when you're responding to a health crisis or you're responding to an environmental crisis, that surge capacity is a lot more amorphous. Mm-hmm. And it isn't something that you can sort of stockpile and point to.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think the good news is that now that we've gone through this, I mean, I think after four or five months, this has been a pretty searing experience for a lot of people. We all know people who've had COVID. Some of us know people who've died. And we're never going to close the National Security Council office on pandemics again. And I think there will be serious consideration to building up a surge capacity in public health where you have people who know how to do contact tracing and can be deployed as needed. They don't have to be sitting there waiting to do that. I think the experience we're having now will prepare us for the future.
Could I just add something here? Arnie frequently gives people reasons why they should vote, and I'll add another one here, because I think that something that makes the public not trust government and also the government kind of fall apart and lose its ability to cope with situations like this the way it has is in part because of the administration. You know, you were talking about Donald Trump. He doesn't really want to be president. He doesn't want to make the government work. He doesn't want to make it more efficient.
But he wants to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all he wants is to win. But I mean, the same thing was true when Reagan won the presidency. I worked at the Justice Department, and there was a clear change in the administration's view of wanting things to work. They rolled back the clock on civil rights. I worked in the Civil Rights Division. And they rolled back the clock on OSHA, and they rolled back the clock on EPA. You know, you need an administration that actually wants to do the job that it that it's doing. And Trump is the worst because he doesn't want anything to work. Mm.
Well, we'll see what happens in November, but that's all I have to say. Linda Feldman, I love you. She writes for the Christian Science Monitor. She's the Monitor's Washington Bureau Chief, political and White House correspondent. We have talked to her in the past. It's always a pleasure to have her on. Thank you, Linda. We'll talk again.
Great. Thank you so much, Arnie.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Part 2 of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I was looking at ProPublica, which I go to on a regular basis. Joining us right now is Ryan McCarthy. Ryan, this piece needs to be discussed on 60 Minutes. This piece needs to be discussed on MSNBC. It's sobering and important. And as we are so frightened about what's going to happen in November with the election, everyone keeps talking about the fact that the answer to this, in order to make people safe and make sure that they protect the integrity of the vote, is that they should do mail voting. And then I read your piece. I was so depressed. And I want you to talk about what you discovered about the Postal Service, what you discovered about the challenges of mail-in voting, and more importantly, what I realized by the end of your piece, which is incredibly extensive, is that if you've developed the muscle of mail-in voting, because you've been doing it for years, you're pretty good at it. Because it requires time, energy, relationship with the Postal Service. You know how to do the system because you've done it over and over again. Well, if we suddenly turn the switch on and ask a lot of states that have never freaking done this before to do it, we're going to be really disappointed. So let me welcome Ryan McCarthy to the program. And Ryan, before you worked for ProPublica, can you just share with my audience a little bit about your experience? Because you're not new to this game. You've been doing it for a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here and to talk about a really important topic. Yeah, so my background before joining ProPublica, I was the editor-in-chief of Vice News, where I helped run their newsroom and helped launch Vice News Tonight on HBO. And prior to that, I worked at the Washington Post and the New York Times and Reuters. And excited to be covering the election for ProPublica this year.
Well, I'm beyond thrilled because you did a phenomenal job. All right, so the article on ProPublica was entitled, ready for this? The Postal Service is steadily getting worse. We kind of knew that. Donald Trump wants them to disappear anyway, and we know that they're practically bankrupt because of what happened in 2006. But anyway, and then the question is, so if it's getting worse, can it handle a national mail-in election? And then this is the subtitle. Postal delays and mistakes have marred primary voting, and after years of budget cuts and plant closures, mail delivery has slowed so much that ballot deadlines in many states are no longer realistic. Just begin at the beginning. I read this piece and I was physically nauseous because it's incredibly sobering, as I am a big supporter of mail-in voting.
Yep.
I'm not sure that it is the answer given what you uncovered. So why don't you walk through this?
Sure.
And give me some hope.
So here's the good news. We'll start with the good news.
Okay.
The good news is, I think you're right. There are states who have developed the muscles to do voting by mail. And those muscles have been built up, in some cases, over a decade. And they've moved slowly to develop a system, which is a complicated system. And it's like running a large business sending out millions and millions of ballots to voters. Places like Colorado and Utah and Washington and Oregon do this really well, but they do this knowing that they're working with a postal service that may not be the postal service you and I would imagine. You know, if we mail a letter, we're pretty reasonably assured it's going to get there relatively on time. Unfortunately, the Postal Service has been hit by over a decade of cutbacks and plant closures that have slowed delivery times. And in fact, they have slowed the delivery times consciously because they just couldn't keep up for first-class mail. And most election mail is sent first-class mail. And so what does that mean? That means that, you know, about, according to an audit from 2018, about 94%, 95% of election mail gets delivered on time nationally. And in some ways, that's pretty good, right? But if you project that over to a national election where you have tens of millions of vote by mail ballots, 5% or 6% or 4% of ballots coming in late could be a colossal disaster. And it could be just wildly confusing to voters. And there's another part of this too, which is that election experts have been warning for years about the need to adjust ballot deadlines and election operations to this slower, more cash-strapped postal service. And the cash-strapped thing is actually really key. In April, they went to Congress and said, we're going to run out of money by September, in part because of the losses related to COVID. And so without that funding, they may not be able to make payroll in September by their own admission. And now there's some evidence that they are doing better as more people shop online since then. But the truth is, a lot of our election laws and a lot of our election logistics around vote by mail have been built with a different postal service in mind, one that is faster and more capable. And in some cases, these vote by mail systems are catered towards people, a small section of each state's population who already vote by mail and already know the rules. Knowing the rules and knowing how long mail takes is going to be a big challenge for election officials this year. That voter education piece is going to
right.
be
tough. So voter education is going to be pretty, but it sounds like where you have to start is with Secretary of State education. And if yes. you don't start with the I get it. I mean, I've been an elected official, so I know how these boys operate. So what I'm reading from your article is that, so it's not your father's post office. It's now a new system. It's delayed. It's the middle of a pandemic. Some of their people are sick. On top of that, you got the plant closures. So that means instead of it going to like the plant that used to be 50 miles away, maybe go to a plant that's 150 miles away, which takes it that much longer to get to. They may lose things in the system because there aren't enough people doing all the other. I mean, your article was just horrifying. I'm just telling you right now, horrifying. It's great. But what I'm hearing is that the first thing that needs to happen to sober people up is before you educate me, you've got to educate the Secretary of State. And that means that the decision, if assuming any kind of vote by mail or absentee balloting, which, for example, in my state, I'll give you an example of my state versus the state of Texas, because that's two states that I cover pretty closely. My state has always been pretty rigid about absentee balloting. But this year, they decided fear of COVID-19 was a disability for the purposes of absentee balloting, which means we all have it because we're all afraid, which means technically we could all absentee ballot, which really is vote by mail, you know, but that's not what they call it. You still have voting available on election day, but for the most part, you're going to see a huge spike in vote by mail. In the state of Texas, they don't call it a disability. You can do some absentee balloting, but they're going to basically just extend the amount of time that you have to vote in person. So that's the way they're doing it versus the way we're doing it. But there's going to be a variation in every theme. But for the most part, you're going to still see, I think, a significant spike in people voting by mail in some way, no matter how you call it. So when you were doing your research and you were talking to the post office and the post people, I know they want to protect the integrity of what they do. And I know want everyone to think they do a great job, even though they're starving and they're underfunded. But are they willing to be honest and have a real sit down with every Secretary of State? Because even if they don't do across the board mail-in voting, you see a huge spike in people still voting in that way in some capacity. Have they started the conversations now?
I think they have. I think it is fair to say they have started those conversations. One thing that my article mentions is a pretty unique series of warnings, including one warning that a USPS official sent to every election administrator in the state of Ohio, essentially warning that their deadlines for requesting an absentee ballot didn't fit with the new reality of the Postal Service. Ohio made, frankly, the mistake of letting voters request a ballot up until noon on the Saturday before a Tuesday election, which, of course, is not enough time to put it back in the mail. And so I think the USPS actually took an active step to warn officials, including the Secretary of State, on that. And USPS has been good about putting election mail coordinators in front of Secretaries of State. Where it maybe hasn't been good is really being honest about just how badly its service has deteriorated over the years. You know, it hasn't hit any of its goals for any of its first-class mail categories in 5 years. It's been deteriorating for the better part of a decade. And I think people deserve to know that. And the U.S. Postal Service is sort of this iconic and frankly essential part of American life. But it's hard to look at its own data and its own goals and say it's really living up to all it could be.
Can I say something? I think it's completely true. And there are huge problems with the Postal Service's ability to do what it needs to do to make mail-in balloting work this November. But I think that one perspective that we should be talking about is who's responsible. When people go to the polls and vote, there are only two entities. There's the ballot clerk and the state there, and there's us, the voter. And we go, and if we fail to get there before they lock the doors, we're out. And if their machines don't work, it's their responsibility to find us another way to vote. But now with this mail-in voting, there's three entities. There's the Postal Service in between, and they're a completely separate entity. I mean, if we had FedEx doing it, it's not their responsibility, the Postal Service's responsibility to figure out how to make voting work. It's the state's responsibility to make sure that people in their state can vote. And they should be guaranteeing that there's a way to make that happen so that people are safe. So I think that trifecta of responsibility is something that people aren't talking about much.
I think that's fair. I think that's really fair. And, you know, I think one of the tricky parts in reporting this out is the Postal Service isn't forthcoming either to states or local election administrators about what mistakes might have been and what happened. And they're not forthcoming with journalists like me either or readers. So I think it can be hard to intertwine where those three entities bear responsibility. But I think that's totally right. In some cases, we're treating the U.S. Postal Service like it should solve our electoral problems. And the truth is, it's not, even in its glory days, it couldn't have done that.
But it's not their job. It's the state's job.
So one of the things, as I'm reading your incredibly extensive article, is you're absolutely right. We should not expect the Postal Service to sort of answer our problems. We know there's a problem with elections. We know there's a problem with the pandemic. We know there's a problem with keeping people safe. We know there's a problem in exercising the franchise because one party wants people to vote, the other party wants voter suppression. And that's another sort of kettle of fish. And so part of the problem is that the Postal Service is now kind of the ping pong ball, you know, between the two parties that, you know, don't want to have a robust turnout and the party that wants to have a robust turnout, but a Postal Service may turn out to be not the robust turnout either. So, you know, one party is thinking, oh, this is our answer. And then I read your article, I'm going, gag me with a spoon, it may not be your answer. But here's my question. There is a problem right now because it is so depleted. There is a problem because it doesn't have personnel. There is a problem because they found, you know, 1,000 votes sitting on a table, you know, ballots sitting on a table that never got delivered, or, you know, they found 300 bundled in a mailbox. And so as I was reading this, it was like a horror story. Why aren't we creating, since it is not necessarily the Postal Service's responsibility, a separate system just for ballots? So you have your blue and red mailboxes, and then during election, you have another kind of a mailbox. It only comes out during election time. It comes out maybe 2 weeks before the election, and it has a big V on it to vote. And what you do is you put it in there, and that's the only thing that goes in there. And then some election officials, we hire personnel to pick them up and vote. Why aren't we doing that? That way we don't depend on the Postal Service that doesn't want to be as honest as it needs to be about the challenges they face, knowing that we don't have the relationship time to build up like they've done in Colorado and Utah and other places and Oregon. But if we don't, why aren't we creating a discrete system because of the pandemic, in fact? And it may turn out that this may be the answer over time, but because of the pandemic and the problems with the Postal Service, we need a third solution.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because there are states that have systems that function a little bit like that, right? So one of the problems here, and this goes back to your point earlier, is the roadmap for developing best practices in vote by mail. It's actually pretty clear and pretty well trod. The states that have done this have a playbook, and they have things like intelligent mail, barcodes on your ballot that'll let you track it and let states and voters know where their ballot is. And drop-off boxes. in states, the big vote by mail states like Colorado and Washington, 60 to 70% of voters don't actually put their filled out ballot in the mail. They put it in a designated drop-off box.
Yes.
Cutting the U.S. Postal Service out of the back end of the process. And that makes a ton of sense, but especially in these rushed early primaries in places like Wisconsin and Georgia and Ohio, they just haven't built up these very very well understood best practices yet. And it's really hurting voters. I think the USPS's official advice is mail your, which I think a lot of voters just don't know, certainly this year, is to mail your ballot in at least 7 days ahead of your state's election. Now, I personally don't know anyone who wants to vote that way, right? The last week of election could have some useful information.
Yeah.
If not for the presidential election, then other ballot races, certainly. And ballot drop-off boxes obviate the need for that, for putting in 7 days.
Ahead. So I keep thinking about, we didn't have ventilators. Then all of a sudden, we all figured out how to make ventilators. You know, we didn't have swabs. And then all of a sudden, we figured out how to make swabs. Well, we're just talking about a little metal box. We're not talking about something that, you know, NASA's going to send up to outer space. We're talking about something that I could build. So, I mean, I'm being funny, but I'm being so powerfully serious. Because you could put a vote box where every post box is. You could put a vote box where every postal office is. You could put, because you know where they are. And you know who can tell us? The Postal Service. They know where every one of their post boxes are. And we already have developed that muscle to go to the post box or to go to the post office. So guess what? It's not going to be teaching a bunch of 90-year-olds what to do because they already know what to do. And the learning curve is so tiny. So what I can't quite believe is that we haven't figured that out. And you know, I know we're waiting for the federal government to like cut checks to help us out, but this isn't a very expensive thing to do. I mean, I want to call Bloomberg up and say, you know, you just spent millions of dollars on that stupid election where you got like 4 votes. Do me a favor. Why don't you write grants to every state in the nation so they can put a damn post box in? It'll probably cost you less and you'll do a good thing for the country, you know? I know I sound like a little old lady who's crazy, but this takes a crazy idea that can be done and isn't so off the charts that it's not possible. And what scares me, Ryan, you're a brilliant writer. You're a great reporter. I can't be the only person to think this is the answer. And I can't be the only person who's sitting in her attic going, I think you should do this. Because in the end, it's only June. Mm-hmm. We could at least do it for November for sure. We may have blown it for some of the primaries, and I apologize for that. But right now, the real get to goal is what happens in November, and we have time to build those boxes. And we have time to train people about those boxes and train the Secretary of State to do it. And frankly, given that we have this time and the Postal Service can still partner with those Secretary of State about where to put those boxes, it could be a win-win, Ryan. And I'm just so terrified that this old bat in the attic is thinking about it in June. And why isn't this front and center and being thought about by every good government group, every Secretary of State, and why isn't it being designed now?
I think that's right. I think, you know, one of the surprising things that I learned in writing this was really just that this is kind of a brute force industry, voting and by mail. You know, when people hear the term absentee ballot, their eyes kind of glaze over because it sounds arcane just off the bat. But really, to your point about ballot drop-off boxes, this is a simple mechanical process for the most part. And, you know, if you look at the states that do it well, not only do they use drop-off boxes, but then they go into USPS facilities and hunt for ballots. They physically do a sweep.
Explain that to me. Compliment the states that have done it because they've gotten it down to a science. But their science has included the Postal Service. So explain to me and to my audience what the idea of a sweep is, because they actually are allowed into where the Postal Service collects and sends out their mail. So tell me what they do.
Well, look, I spent in a previous career, I spent many years as a bartender and a waiter and working in kitchens in various fashions. And every night before you could leave, you had to do a sweep. to make sure that you had cleaned every possible part of the kitchen and you know, dining room. And I think there's a similar impulse here, which is to say these massive mail facilities like the one in Denver mentioned in the article process millions of pieces of mail per day. And while we all wish to be automated like robots, the truth is some stuff is just going to get lost in the cracks. And some people are not going to get the message, and some stuff is going to come in late and be unbundled. And so that last, a literal, very like brute force mechanical process of hunting for ballots in a warehouse, in a USPS warehouse, can actually make sure that people's votes count. So I totally agree with you that this is sort of a will issue, a political will issue, and not necessarily just a factor of money. And it's also a matter of responsibility too, because if you look at what happened in Georgia this time around, you had the Republican Secretary of State blaming some of the counties, not all of the counties, but blaming the counties for what happened there and lack of training. And you almost got no one really wanting to step up and take responsibility for the disaster that happened in so many jurisdictions there. And I think that's sort of a metaphor for our decentralized election system in a lot of places. In Wisconsin, it's all municipal elections. So you had very different counting procedures for absentee ballots in some cases, in one town as opposed to the other. So I think in some ways, what we're asking to do is sort of a collective action, right? We're trying to make this massive shift to vote by mail as a nation in a system that has decentralized management and responsibility. And that's gonna be really tough.
One of my closest friends runs elections in her little town. And we were talking about this and she's sort of out of her mind. And she doesn't really like mail-in voting. She likes the idea of people coming in. But she's old. She's got underlying health conditions. She has cancer. And everybody that works with her has underlying health conditions because they all have blue hair. So she's not so sure that she wants to actually have people voting. But she thinks in a lot of ways what's happening right now is the worst of all possible ideas. You're going to have some people showing up. You're going to have some people absentee balloting, which means it's going to require a lot more personnel to come in and open all those envelopes and then read all those numbers. Plus, she's going to still have to staff at the same time. I mean, if you're talking about local, it's even more chaotic than you could possibly imagine. I should give you her name. You should talk to her. Because
I'd love to.
No, she's so eloquent, but she also explains why now it's the worst of everything. And she actually needs more people to do even more things at a time when everyone's even more frightened. So in a lot of ways, you're not solving problems by having every kind of system in place. But knowing that, again, which is why I really want your piece on 60 Minutes. Which is why I want your piece on MSNBC and CNN, because it's so sobering, but it also, like Arnie with the bingo and the light over her head, goes, but there's an answer. And the answer is not threatening, and the answer is not sophisticated, and the answer kind of means that we have to sort of do it together, something that we don't always do so well. But I think people are realizing that they have a respect for the franchise. They also respect the pandemic and the fear of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So they want people to be able to trust the outcome. And those little boxes that say vote on them next to every postal box is something people could understand and trust, because it's not a machine. It's them putting it in the box. And in a way, the less sophisticated and the more obvious, the more people are going to trust the result. And I am more afraid of trusting the result than almost anything else. And right now I see only chaos going into November. And after reading your article, I see an answer to chaos. But I wouldn't have even known I needed an answer if I hadn't understood what was going on with the Postal Service and about the level of sophistication those states that have a history of working with the Postal Service have brought to the table that we just don't have the time to do with all the other states.
You know, the Postal Service actually has experience with dual boxes. I remember when they came out with express mail service, and they would have a separate box for the express mail. And everybody knew that it was in the same place as the regular box. And if you want to send it express mail, if you want to do it on election day as a vote, you put it in the separate box. So, you know, they've done it before. The other thing I wanted to say is, Brian, you were talking, tell me if you think this makes sense. You're talking about the primaries and all the problems with the primaries, and we don't want to have the same problem again. I think part of that problem is that the primaries were planned very quickly. COVID had just come on, and people hadn't made a commitment to do it one way. And now we have time for the powers that be to actually make decisions well enough in advance that, yes, indeed, we're going to do this by mail. And so how are we going to plan that? And then they read Ryan's article that says, well, we really can't depend on the Postal Service to make voting by mail happen if we go the usual route. So what do we need to do in order to make this work? But they have to make a commitment. And part of the problem is we have the president saying, I don't want to do it by mail because mm-hmm. too many people might actually vote. So we don't know if it's going to be by mail or not by mail. But if we make a commitment to doing it, just the decision one way or the other as to how we're going to do it, and then we plan for how to make it work. And your article has closed the information gap, told us that there's this issue we have to deal with. Go deal with it. We can do it.
I think that's a very excellent point. And I think the issue of trust, which you both hit on earlier, is pretty important. I mean, keep in mind, the Postal Service has been demonized by Republicans and by Trump. And there are very good reasons why people wouldn't trust our election results, just given the polarization right now, particularly given what the president has said. And they may not trust those election results, particularly if they're delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. And so there's a twin problem there about legitimacy and process that folks just may not buy into depending on their political beliefs. So I think if we can get the power or get the systems being built by local, state and local officials who can get outside of some of these political footballs or these political minefields, then I think people will have a better chance at buying into whatever results happen. But the Postal Service, I have to tell you, is a toxic thing in Washington. Everyone professes to love it. No one wants to take on reforming it. And no one wants to get on, at least the Republicans don't want to get on the bad side of the president. So it's just sort of a quagmire.
Well, and the problem began in 2006 when they had to pre-fund sure. the retirement, which is just insane. So this has been, it has been eroding for a long time. There isn't time, even if we cut them gazillion dollar checks, it couldn't fix what's wrong because you can't open new facilities and you can't hire
right.
enough people and we're in the middle of a pandemic anyway. So I want to give them the funding. I want to repeal that 2006 requirement, but that's a systemic problem. That's a long-term solution.
Yeah.
We need a short-term practical solution. And I'm going to remind everyone that if we can send a man to the moon, and if we can, you know, we can do that amazing like thing that was just went up the other day by NASA and whatever, we can figure this out because it isn't rocket science, which is wonderful. And I think that's the other part that's just so perfect about your article is that it takes the scale away off our eyes. It explains to us why we can't be Colorado because we haven't had the time and the experience. So if we're not, what's the happy sort of medium in between those two? We're now a little more experienced with the pandemic, so we understand how to sort of, you know, mask up and social distance. We can also figure out how to sue some kind of mail-in voting. It may not be the U.S. Postal Service, but there may be another vehicle for us to do that that'll feel like the Postal Service, but ain't the Postal Service. So, Ryan McCarthy, you are fabulous. This is the most incredible article. The Postal Service is steadily getting worse. Can it handle a national mail-in election? I don't know how many shows you can get on. I don't know whether you can get on Bill Maher. I don't know whether you can get on every late night show, but it is an important story because it is so illustrative of the problem and explains it in a practical way, but it also then gives us opportunity to find a practical solution. And if that practical solution is possible, then we need to do it now. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and stay safe.
All right, you too. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.